David, whether you have a few weeks old puppy or a senior who's seen multiple decades, any dog person like me knows the most valuable thing in the world is spending time with your pet.
Yep.
The farmer's dog makes it easy to keep them healthy, which can give you more quality years with your lovely dog.
Yeah, well, I've heard Farmer's Dog makes and delivers fresh, healthy dog food. And, you know, that's what everyone's looking for. It's recommended by vets, nutritionally balanced. It's made from human-grade ingredients, safe, clean kitchens. All that stuff matters.
Yeah. I mean, you love your dog. Why get the lousy food for your dog? Farmer's Dog is the best. Traditional dry and wet dog food options are extremely processed.
Sometimes
they use
dogs...
much lower quality. Yeah.
you put it in their bowl and they go, what is this kibble? And they knock it away. What is this canned goo?
Oh, yeah. I've had our dog, yeah, look at the bowl and then kind of crank its neck up and look at me. And it was like, really?
They go, really? Why don't you go first? You want a bite of this? Slop?
And it makes that sound.
Here you go, dog.
So Farmer's Dog isn't just higher quality food. They also send the food pre-portioned specifically for your dog based on their unique nutritional needs. It makes it easy to help your dog reach and stay at their ideal weight, David, and which is one of the biggest indicators of a full, healthy life. A fresh diet has been found to have all sorts of benefits, David, from healthier coat and skin, better breath, if you want to kiss your dog, and even easier digestion and smaller and better poops.
Let's look at a clip. It doesn't matter if your dog's young or old, it's always the right time to invest in their health for more happy years with your dog. Get 50% off your first box at farmersdog.com/fly.
Let the Farmer's Dog know we sent you. Use your code or click podcast after you sign up for your first box.
And now for a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends all before you head out the door. Your money's a workaholic, but you don't have to be because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Today's guest, David, is probably one of the most influential producers of television of all time, I mean, especially right now. Ted Sarandos of Netflix, who's in charge of billions of dollars allocated to shows and is also an incredible Saturday Night Live and stand-up comedy fan. And he's a very good friend of David's. I know him casually, but he's a really nice guy. David?
I agree. He knows SNL. He knows the podcast. He listens and has comments all the time, which is very nice for a guy who could not be more busy. We talked about his schedule. We talked about all these shows he has to keep an eye on, the pressures of being the boss. I always think of him up in those in the world of those guys that run companies like Bezos. I think you were saying, you know, Ted's so normal. He's not jacked and juiced yet.
He's the most regular, humble person you'd ever meet. He has not gotten on a boat.
He hasn't made a boat. Yeah, he hasn't made a rocket ship yet. But he's just a powerful guy that's very low key. So I like that kind of thing. Very fun, great laugher, knows a ton about comedy. And we get into different comic specials. And he gets a lot of pressure sometimes when things seemingly go too far. And what do you do about that? And we had a lot of great talk with him and all his shows he's doing that are hitting. And how do you know when the shows are hitting?
All over the world. You know, what the Squid Game meant to these streaming platforms and one of the biggest hits in history and the authenticity of it and why. And so it's really just about the future. All this
it's a lot of learning. Yeah, a lot of learning for me. And I usually think I know everything and I didn't, shockingly.
Yeah, I tried to. I was a little pithy in the beginning. Netflix, Flex, what do you got? You know, and I was kind of. I said but you know, these live streaming shows and what they're doing and what the globalization, the monetization, and any other zations? Can you add in there?
No, I think those are the zations.
That was good. But it was a really fun talk, and we laughed a lot, and he loves comedy. Bada bing, bada boom.
Here he is, Ted Sarandos.
Ted Sarandos, what is your official title right now? Because it seems to jump around. Chief Executive Creative.
I'm the co-CEO of Netflix.
Holy tomato. So does Reed Hastings has to worry about anything? Is any reason? No,
Reed is kind of, he's the chairman of the board now. And he just goes off and he has other, he's very focused on his philanthropy and
ice fishing.
He's built a ski mountain in Utah, actually.
Wow.
He owns Powder Mountain.
Ooh.
Sounds like a Neil Young song. All to be on Powder Mountain. Sorry.
With the double meaning from the
I don't know about Neil.
Oh yeah.
Cannabis, but so you don't have a jettison. Like if you weren't doing this, what would you want to do?
Honestly, next year I'm 25 years at Netflix. And so my whole career has been in either video stores or video distribution or Netflix.
Yes.
So if I was not doing this, I'd be probably doing many of the same things. Because like I always thought if I didn't have to make money, I would operate a movie, like a retrospective movie theater or something like that.
Well, you're like Quentin Tarantino in that you both were steeped in movies from working and you managing regional video stores. And now you just said you'd like to have a vintage movie theater, and Tarantino has one of those in L.A.
Yeah.
So, do you mind if I call you Quentin for the rest of the interview?
Please, I will direct 10 movies in my lifetime.
That's right.
They just ripped one down by the Grove. Is that true, Ted? There's one on. There was one on Beverly by the Grove in Fairfax, old school one.
It closed down to remodel and just never reopened.
Hopefully they're opening a Club Monaco or something important there.
So I'd like to leave with this because it might put a smile on your face. So this is trending. In these last few weeks,
the kids are all talking about this.
Well, this is like media that covers companies. Netflix won the streaming wars. Does that make you smile? Make you go, we got a lot of work to do? Or does that scare you in a way? Netflix won the streaming wars with 260 million subscribers.
Well, 2 years ago, they were writing, bring in the paddles. I think we lost them.
I know, you're right. It turned.
I told everyone here, don't take that headline seriously or take this headline seriously. That implies that the streaming wars are over. It's streaming is just the natural evolution of media. It's what people want because it's on demand and it's in their control and they get tons of choice and the economics are so much better than the old pay TV model used to be. So I just think it's a natural course, and it's very earliest days. So there's no war that's over, but there's lots of battles, and we're going through a nice
comedians doing Saturday Night Live theme podcast war has not been declared over, but we're in the conversation. Here's what my blink curious thing about you: you guys have a show, and you think it's going to be a smash, and whatever metrics you're using, billions, and it just does, it underperforms and like, oh, holy shit. Or the opposite. Yeah. Okay, well, let's take a chance on that one. I don't know. And it's a smash.
Yeah.
So Squid Game versus.
What was the biggest smash sort of surprise? Was Squid Game's
Squid Game is the most watched. Yeah, it's the most watched show in the history of the company around the world, including in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it was a surprise in that it was really meant, like all of our local productions are meant to be thrilling to the local population, and they're not meant to be engineered to be global or anything. What we have found is that the more authentically local a show is, weirdly, the more it travels, because I think people see it as authentic, as more authentic and real. So in that case, it was a relatively expensive Korean television show, but it actually just within about 3 days on Netflix, it just exploded everywhere.
So nuts. Did you pick it up or did you go produce it and put it together?
So the director Wang, who was pitching it, had pitched it around the world for about 10 years as a movie. And our Korea team, which is incredible, in our office in Seoul, met with him and said, this is a pretty on-the-nose Korean cinema, sci-fi story. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about exploring it and opening the world up a lot more? And came up with the idea of, and he went off and rewrote the scripts.
Smart.
Yeah. Korean shows.
I saw a picture on your Instagram. Ted, I don't follow many people. So this is sort of.
I'm gonna hear this one.
I think you're on the set of
Squid Game 2. Yeah. Season 2, and they're shooting right now. It was this place like 3 hours outside of Seoul. So it was like a fun cultural immersion. You know what they have in Korea? That's incredible. The road stop, the rest stops.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they do.
You know, ours are kind of scary in the United States.
Or they're closed, you know? Yeah.
The ones here, spotless clean in Korea, spotless clean. Like have like top line, like very high end food courts in them and all the regional foods. Like people, like if you live there, you'd actually drive to the rest stop to get the regional food from that area of Korea.
Go on dates. Go to the.
It's a good date night. It's a good date night.
You know, so Netflix, you guys, the red envelopes and the DVDs. So that was a revolution at the time.
Yep.
Then
weirdly, only mailed our last DVD about 4 months
ago. That's what I heard about, because there was something just nice about it. The consistency of the branding, the red envelope, and the ease of that. So that was like you and Reed and your other people work with you.
Yeah.
Breaking something new. Then, of course, watch on your computer. You can watch a movie on computer. Yeah. And I do think House of Cards was the first that I remember live streaming. And my wife and I didn't even know about live streaming. We had a bad Wi-Fi connection, so it would stop every 2 minutes and we'd have to do this whole thing. And we just thought, well, maybe it'll get better in the future. But anyway, that was a big thing. Like Netflix, you know, your brand completely shifted with that decision. Was a huge, huge moment for your company, right? At that time, 10 years ago.
Yeah, you know, it was 2012. And at the time, we were building the business up to do streaming. But what's interesting about it is Reed Hastings, this incredible visionary, when I met him in 1999, he talked about Netflix just like this. And it's all digital, totally global. The only thing he didn't see in that vision was doing original programming. He thought this would be a better distribution solution, but you know, we're a tech company, we weren't a creative company.
Mm-hmm. Like Blockbuster, but you just pick one that goes out.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Something like that.
Yeah. So for us, I went and so we were just in a routine meeting with the producers of House of Cards, who also produced a bunch of movies, and they said this was going to be their first TV package, and did we want to look at it? And I looked at the package that they put in front of us, which was, you know, David Fincher directing television, this Oscar-nominated writer writing the scripts, and Kevin Spacey, when that was a good thing, starring Robin Wright.
Great actor. Yeah.
Reed Hastings didn't have any psychic visions about him?
No. but when they brought it in, I said, look, if we were ever going to get into originals, this would be the one. It's like the perfect package. We had three scripts. So it wasn't like we had to do all the development work. And I looked at it and I said, we greenlit the show. We kind of famously gave them a 2-season order, which was pretty unheard of at the time. Yeah. But mostly because there's no reason you would take a desirable show to Netflix back then.
Just to get ahead of it, did you overpay? What did you pay?
Yeah. I mean, we paid, basically it was about $100 million commitment to the show.
But I don't think anyone's even heard of that much money back then.
At the time, I remember it was bold. It was full boat, as they call it, money.
So then all in.
So we did the move. I came back. I tell Reed that I made the deal. And he's like, well, I thought we don't do this. And I said, yeah, I go. But for me, honestly, it was if this show works, it will fundamentally change the course of our business. And if it doesn't, we'll have overpaid for a show, which we do all the time. So,
well, if it was a race, you got out of the blocks first, and everyone went, whoa, there's hit shows. Cause the show of the moment was on Netflix.
Yeah.
And so that's huge.
And people forget too, before we did that, we had like 25 million people streaming on Netflix. So if you start, you know, if I tried to build the whole business on our original programming over the last 10 years, we would not be where we're sitting right now.
Well, the other thing, I don't know if it's revolutionary, but putting shows that like Arrested Development that get rediscovered on Netflix has become another lane in your brand. Obviously, The Office was huge and so forth and so on. So you had to pay a lot for that. Those were gambles at the moment, right?
Well, remember when we were licensing at the beginning, all those shows, nobody really knew what this right was, the streaming rights for a show. Mm-hmm. It was either a home video right or a digital right. And the people didn't really know. Different studios had it all constructed differently. When it came to, so television, what we were able to license was shows that didn't have enough seasons to get the syndication mm-hmm. and were off the air.
Okay.
So weirdly, Arrested Development was off the air the year that we were going. And so we had the ability to do Arrested Development. And on DVD, it was a very popular show. So we knew that from our own DVD rental data, mm-hmm. was that people loved the show. And I actually think that for Arrested Development was one of those shows that was literally ahead of its time.
Yeah.
You know, most people say that when they're trying to make you feel good because your show bombed. This thing really was ahead of its time. Like if you watched it, you really had to binge it because the joke sets up in episode one and pays off in episode four. And you really kind of have to watch it in one sitting to see that play out. And binging, you know, streaming on Netflix was a way to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's why that one of our earliest decisions after House of Cards was to reboot Arrested Development.
So it's sort of hunch plus data.
Yeah,
And plus you're a comedy fan, and so you like good comedy, and that's, you're like, this one's actually sort of a clever, interesting comedy people would appreciate. And the fact they blow up, you know, really reinvigorates a lot of these shows. Yeah, Suits especially.
Who knew Suits was Suits? Crazy, but that was, you know, in the earliest, and Breaking Bad and Walking Dead. We had all those shows right after they were on, right after in the season after they aired on television. Mm-hmm. And they were small, culty shows that just blew up because of Netflix.
Yeah.
Wow. Sure. Breaking Bad.
Now, you got into, you're into more live stuff now, and we did the Chris Rock thing. And
yeah, so you guys were so part of that history with us.
I was afraid to talk. I never felt more like a white guy in my life. But like, I should just stay quiet right now. But I got to hang out with Jabbar backstage and talk to him about
it. Yeah.
So that was a thrill.
It was fun. It was fun.
You're going more into live, is that just one
sports
area that you guys haven't quite cracked, or what are you looking for in live? What is appealing live that you guys gravitate toward?
So I'm looking for things that actually are creatively better because they're live. Mm. But you know, Saturday Night Live is one of those things that people tune into to see what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I do think part of the liveness of it is part of the pitch. Chris Rock Live was an exciting one for us because, you know, it had been a year that Chris had not talked about what happened at the Oscars, and he was going to in that set, and there was enough built up, you know, people wanted to hear that story, that the liveness of it really mattered. So it was the most watched streaming comedy special since they started tracking it. And I know internally it was the most talked about for sure of the year. Because people were so people were rushing home to watch
and
the Chris
Rock. What about the after show? How did that do in terms of numbers?
It held on. It held on both the pregame and the, no, it actually did. It was fun to do because talk about like working without a net. We had never streamed anything live and we actually did it in two different cities and pitched back and forth and all this stuff. So our teams were really chomping off a bunch.
Are you ironing it all out now? Like every time you do it, it's a little easier. What have you done since? What are you're doing a tennis thing.
Tennis
coming up, right?
March 3rd.
and Saturday night we have the SAG Awards live on Netflix as well.
Okay.
Saturday night. Yeah, and then we just announced we did this big deal with WWE, so WWE Raw is going to be on every week on Netflix starting in 25. You got the tennis one coming, and then we're going to do a bunch of live stuff from the Netflix is a Joke Festival this summer.
Oh, right. So you can sort of how much lead time? Sorry, Dana. How much lead time do you need if you say, you know, something's coming up, it sounds kind of cool, can we get in there?
I remember we hadn't been built for live. So this is all technology for
it's
us.
All
so
new.
We probably need 60 days or so to get the resources lined.
Yeah, that's the right answer. Thank you.
Yeah,
very good. Excellent. Here's a business question. I don't know if you want to answer, but the NFL, the money that they're getting, and I don't know if I got this right, but I believe Amazon, maybe you're a competitor.
I've heard of them.
They paid $1 billion for 8 or 10 Thursday night footballs. Is that right?
Something in that area.
Yeah.
In that zip code. Yeah.
Bezos, man, that son of a gun. He's on the yacht.
Son of a bitch.
I think actually it shows you like the thing I always talk about. I'm not like people say, Netflix is against live sports for some reason. No, we're not at all. Just that those big league live sports, the demand for them is so great that the whatever distributor is doing it doesn't really bring much value to it. So they don't get much margin for it. They don't get much profit out of that. And so we were able to, over the last 25 years, build a gigantic company without having a loss leader product.
Right.
And I think sports generally, big league sports, tends to be a loss leader for television. So at some point, you know, I'm very confident we can be twice as big as we are today without doing that. But who knows beyond that?
Are you talking a 500 million subscribers? If I run the numbers right in my head,
you've rounded down.
You've done the math pretty well.
Well, you're at 260, and you can double it.
Wait, Dana, what about that Paramount Plus bullshit when they try to throw that in?
I hate those guys.
That drove me nuts.
I don't like. I like Netflix. I don't like those Paramount Plus guys. I don't like them.
Listen,
they try to put them.
I'm in my hotel trying to hook my phone up to my laptop to my TV, and I got a. Antenna on the ceiling. I'm like, how do I get parent? I just want to come home, watch the goddamn game. But if that's the future,
You're talking about Peacock. Peacock did
Peacock
that.
Peacock forced for the playoff game. You had to join Peacock.
Yeah.
Anybody. Yeah, it was Peacock.
People did. It tells you how, like, again, 26 million people or something watched it, but they went from nothing to that. So it's the big people like football, turns out.
Sure. But it was sort of a forced situation I didn't love.
Well, to your point, it's live. You don't know what's going to happen. There's a huge gambling component. And then
very much so.
The Taylor Swift effect of like millions
fantasy football.
Fantasy bets. Football. Yeah. And millions of young women now like are interested in football.
To gamble.
Yeah.
And gamble. And
they like to gamble too. You're right, Dan.
They want them to gamble. They can come lose and play fantasy football when I lose. It's very addictive losing.
I'm not gonna put in a pitch for this for them, but I saw a product that the NFL is working on that basically incorporates all your fantasy football picks, your gaming and everything. So you're watching on an you pull out your iPad and watch the game through the lens of
It's almost like a screen where it's also all that shit while you're watching. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, the future is like, I'm surprised states don't have gambling everywhere because everyone's willing to lose everything just to gamble. And it seems to be everywhere. Some states I land, I can't play it on my phone. Some I can.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/wall to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/wall. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Ted's from Arizona, Dana, just so FYI.
I remember you two guys are print. Arizonians.
Arizonians.
Yeah.
And Dana, you met some of my high school buddies.
I did. It was interesting because I have a lot of the same friends that I had in high school or in college. And so it was neat that all your friends were just knew you when and just completely real, regular people.
You haven't dumped them yet.
It wasn't like an Oscar party there. I mean, Jason Bateman was there. It was cool to meet him. David Spade was there.
Mr. Chappelle was there. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That was a fun night.
By the way, with Chappelle, I got two stories for Chappelle. Just to interrupt you.
Yeah.
He's really good at it.
One is just, first of all, I think it's nice that you're, you know, I've known you as a comedy fan for years and years, and so that's truly who you are. So when you back people when they do a special, or you have to come out and get in front of something and say, I do back a comedian saying what they want, doesn't mean you agree with it. Doesn't mean let people talk. I think that's commendable, especially we're comics. So, of course, we like that.
And, definitely. It's a big bookstore. You can open any book you want or not, you know.
And so. People like to think about all kinds of diversity except for diversity of thought. and I think comedy is one of these places where you should have a pretty open playground to figure out, you know, ideas. And ideas, you know, have to live through conversation. And I think comedy is a great place to start the conversation.
And right. And some people don't agree. Some people do. Yeah, and it's under the guise of a joke. Sometimes it's
it's in the title. It's a joke. Yeah. It's in the title.
It's not my stock and trade, but I do think the comedic mind, you're not supposed to say this, makes you want to say it. You know, you can say all these things up, but not that thing. You're like, well, wait a minute. You know, if it,
You immediately want to crack that puzzle, right?
Yes. Yeah. Right. I mean,
Watching comedy, you sometimes people like that when they say, oh, he went pretty far. I don't agree with that, but they're trying stuff. It's not the same six jokes that everyone's allowed to use.
I think it's funny. I think that people like, you know, when they talk about comedy and try to put it into camps and like, well, some people talk to work blue and some people don't, and one's better than the other. I actually think it's an art form that has a lot of different shapes. And if you, some people like if you do shock comedy, the hard thing I've been watching a lot of comedy over the years, like the hard thing is getting the audience back. So it's actually just a different kind of art when you went out and got, because it's not just a cheap laugh. You have to actually rein the audience back in too. So it's you have to be able to master a lot of different things.
And you also have to have a clever angle. I mean, if you want to keep a crowd, if you're going to do these things, if you have an interesting angle or something that comes out of nowhere, I think it makes it smarter and it's more fun to listen to, but you're also more of a connoisseur. You've been doing it all your life and now you're seeing every special. And then you've got Hannah Gatsby, you've got the different ranges of people, and then people get mad at you and then they come back and do a special again. And you're like, okay, well, I think down deep they know you're letting these things go on. So they go, oh, this is the place to do it.
Yeah. And I think it's a hard thing for me too, that, you know, the keep in mind that we try to do a lot of variety, because just like Netflix itself, people like some shows and I'm like, oh, that's why we have so much to watch on Netflix, because tastes are really diverse and it's certainly within comedy. So for the point I was trying to make when people got angry was this idea that, you know, if you don't like that idea, switch it and find another one, find one you do like.
Yeah. Sure. It seems pretty simple.
A lot of choices.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what about Chappelle when we had your party the other night and he has all these people over the Grammys, Chappelle's up for one. I think Wanda Sykes, maybe, maybe Aziz was up for one and Chris Rock.
Sarah Silverman.
Yeah. Ted went around. First of all, it's the most fun, Dana. You were invited. You couldn't come, but you're obviously invited.
I heard all about it.
It's so fun. So he's got two tables. It's pretty much only comedians. We all have a place setting. And so you sit down. And then Ted walks around, and it's pretty hard to do this, Ted. Stops at each person. Sarah Silverman's here, and she's done this and this, and we all know her from this and this. And then I go, oh my God, he's doing it to everyone. And it's so hard. He had to keep us entertained, know the credits, know something about the person. And he's going down, up and down. Remember this, Ted?
Yeah, I know you're heading.
And he gets, and so Arsenio Hall was outside. You remember this? So he's outside. Ted has already thanked Dave Chappelle, you know, all the people actually up for a Grammy for the dinner. And he does this whole thing about Chappelle. Very nice. Then Chappelle's standing behind me for some reason. And so when Ted gets to me, right when he gets to me to just fawn over me for...
I was about to fawn.
Fawn. And he was really just working his way to the main event, which is me. And then, so Arsenio goes, do Dave Chappelle, he's hiding behind you. And you're politely like, well, I did talk about Dave, but, you know, I'll say a few words again. And Dave takes the mic.
There was a mic? Okay.
Was there a mic?
No mic. He just took the mic.
Okay, he's got a voice. Yeah. And he says, I can't believe I'm here with all my favorite comedians. He's so nice. And then he starts going to each person, and I'm like, wait, is he doing what Ted's doing? And
so Ted now, just do that?
Yeah. So now we're all, I'm staring because I've got, there's a little shrubbery on the tables, but I've got Ali Wong and Bill Hader right in front of me. So, and Rock is behind me. So I'm next and Ted's just waiting to keep going. And Chappelle did probably 15 minutes. He did like a set. And then he stopped and then Ted's like, and David Spade, he had to get right. It was like, and the professor and Marianne, he kind of wrapped it up. He's like, oh, and there's Chris Rock and blah, 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 blah. But it was pretty hilarious because everyone was waiting.
I'll tell you a very short story about Ted, because I do think it speaks to your vibe.
Please.
Ted's character. of someone in your position, I would just say you don't have an ego around it at all, and that informs you all the time. Because we know heads of big things in Hollywood, you know, there's a lot of, you know, hey kid, and you know, all that kind of stuff. And you're the opposite. So Mike Myers and I, Wayne's World, 280
excellent.
Inflation adjusted, 400 million.
100 quillion.
Inflation adjusted. So we're sitting at a table and Ted comes over. There's no chair around. So Ted takes a knee beneath Mike and I and talks to us for 15 minutes as a fan of all comedy and everything. I mean, it was the most, you know, and then...
Sounds about right.
I said, well, Ted, you're, you know...
Very nice, yeah.
And
Ted's very polite.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's like, he goes, this was my favorite moment of the Oscars. And he leaves, and I said to my wife, well, that's the guy who runs Netflix, you know? She's like, what?
She goes, who's that Joker?
Who comes over? So anyway, I just wanted the audience to know that about you.
Thank you,
that's why people come to your house, and you're popular for a guy in that position you're in. You wear it very well. That's all I'll say.
Well, thank you, man. I think probably I came to this completely as a fan. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of folks in my role worked their way up from the mailroom or from the, you know, from the junior development positions and those kind of things. They got grinded down to a place where they don't really like the thing they do anymore. Mm-hmm. And I love it. And I love creative people. I love what you do for the world. And for me, it's like, I think it's really, it's what makes me bounce out of bed in the morning because I feel like I'm doing something that matters to people. And really it's what you do and it's enabling that is the important part.
It sounds overwhelming to have so much on your plate because I don't even know if you still sit in pitch meetings but there's probably too many things going on, but just the global, the markets and what's going to be a hit.
It's huge.
And what's going to get
you have to love it because the hours suck.
Oh my God. Just the fact you go to the set and go to Seoul to go to that, just that's 3 days out of your life just for one thing.
And Dana, you probably know this too, but when I say I came to this as a fan, growing up in Phoenix, it wasn't that easy to be a fan of entertainment. Didn't really come to Phoenix that much.
Wasn't bumping.
No. And then David, I remember because I used to, in Arizona, I grew up, the drinking age was 19. So you could start sneaking into bars when you're like 16, 17. And, all my friends went to the different dance clubs and that kind of stuff. And I didn't dance. So I used to go to the comedy club and I would see a young David Spade, you know, early. And by the way, I was thinking about this the other night when I was seeing David do his standup, this is like Anderson's Fifth Estate, NFL, Chuckles,
NFL
Finny
Club,
Bones.
Chuckles, mm-hmm. Finny Bones.
Okay. David would get up and do something that was, I couldn't put my finger on because hadn't yet seen enough comedy, I think, to understand how different what you were doing was in Arizona. You were doing like a New York brand of comedy that I had not seen before. And I know you're not from New York, so it wasn't that.
Right.
But it was that level of kind of, and when I finally realized what you were doing is at Chuckles one night, I went to see Belzer. Mm-hmm. And I go, oh, that is the vibe. That's the rhythm. That's the sarcasm, the whole bit of it. Like that to me is for the clearest line I could see from someone else to what you were doing at that time was Belzer.
Oh, that's not, you know, when I started, I only knew people from the Tonight Show, you know, I'd only watched that.
Yeah.
So I was sort of luckily not so influenced by, if I grew up on the East Coast, you're seeing 10 comics a night at the clubs, you know, and they're all pretty smooth. And so not knowing as much, I'm doing weirder bits because I don't know what's right or wrong. You're just trying stuff that's funny to me and my friends. And that sort of helped me. And I only really got into the improv when I came out. I think I was 19 or I was 20 because I just, looking back, I had a different look. I had a kind of a clever act, not a ton of material, but I was blonde hair. Everyone else was Belzer. It was Leno, Belzer, all those guys.
But it was the confidence level that Belzer has on stage. That's what I saw. And it was very interesting to see it in a very young guy.
Yeah. And there's really no confidence there.
Fake it till you make it. I saw Belzer catch a rising star in the 70s, I think.
Yeah.
And he was doing, he was the ultimate just powerhouse, cocky. And he was doing a bit about a proctology bit. You know, keep out of my ass. Okay.
Here's a 20. Stay out of my ass.
And then, you know, obviously he was an influence on Dennis Miller, who then took it to his own place, but that kind of sarcasm and specificity, I see a lot of Dennis and David at times, and sure. also calling back quickly words and references. So, yeah.
And I think that this idea that if something didn't work, it wasn't the end of the set or the end of my day. It's like you had to just flow right into something that make fun of the audience for not laughing at the joke.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes when I first went on at Chuckles at an amateur night, my literally first night, the guy said, I think I told you this, Dana, when I get off, just some guys, just the manager, he doesn't probably give a fuck about comedy. But I go, hey, man, how was it? Knowing I bombed. But I wanted to come back, even though it's probably free to do 4 minutes. And he goes, I don't know, it was all right. He goes, actually, what you said between was funnier. And then he walked away, and I was like, and then that's my whole life. That's my whole life.
Self-deprecating.
You knew what to do. Yeah, you knew
what
to do.
Throwaway jokes, this kind of thing, yeah. And then it just turned into that.
Yeah, you were the opposite of please love me. Maybe I was in that mode at one point. Come on, everybody!
In those Phoenix days, Dana, I saw you at the Celebrity Theater.
Oh, did you see that SNL show with Kevin Nealon, Dana, and
Was it
Dennis?
Me, Dennis, and yeah. Kevin?
Oh, yeah. That's unreal. I saw that. I was so jealous. That was the Swatch tour. I think I just went to watch.
Yes.
I wasn't on SNL yet, and I was like, holy shit. I think they were getting $6,000 a night, and I was shitting. Yeah. I couldn't believe it.
I remember that show, because it was the three of us, and I don't know. I think I came back, and then I'm on stage, and someone had a big stock of broccoli, and threw it as hard as they could, hit me in the back. Hit John Broccoli.
Hit you in the back.
I went back with Mike Myers there, actually, and he opened for me. But that was a... That's a cool theater. I mean, In the Round can be tricky, but I remember
that's
that
where
was
Nate Bergazzi did a special. Yeah.
Louis,
that was an embarrassment of riches for comedy because it was drivable from L.A.
Yeah,
so all the comedians who they can go and work on the weekends in Phoenix.
Oh, always great audiences. The improv and stuff like sophisticated but not cynical. You know,
I always thought it'd be terrible audiences because it was hot, so people would be working outside and a little bit drunk and tired from being hot. But the audiences always were great.
Yeah,
you know what's funny Ted's my same age, Dana, and I think, right, Ted? And
yeah,
so
47.
When you grow up in Arizona, I was like so into Gilligan's Island and, you know, Happy Days and Mork and Mindy. And it's funny that you can laugh at those and be so, and love them so much, but later you go, that's a little corny or that's a little not what I do. It's hard to steer because you're told that's funny, you know. All those shows, they were funny, though.
Yeah.
I don't know what about it, but it wasn't totally my style. But at the time, I couldn't get enough of those shows. Those shows?
Oh, yeah. But that for comedians, there were tropes. I mean, one thing you would do, this is an old reference, but you get the microphone cord, you'd go up and you'd wave the microphone cord and go, rolling, 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 keep them doggies going, ride. You know,
that's
there was a lot of those little closer.
Don't tell everyone that.
I would do all that stuff, you know.
I haven't seen him around in a while, but Tim Thomerson, remember that guy?
And
we did all of Stagecoach and
all the John Wayne stuff. Well, we're going over the hill, Pappy. And all the sound effects. Yeehaw!
Yeah.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime. Day or night. Oh, yes, you heard me right. You can talk to an actual human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Are you catching the big game or making big mods, going on that first date or installing that first brake kit? Binging that new show or watching install videos? When you're a real car lover, the choice is obvious. eBay Motors has you covered with over 122 million parts to fit your number one ride or die.
Brake kits, turbochargers, LED headlights, exhaust kits, bumpers, roof racks, and engines. Whether you're into the speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has all the parts you need for the ride you love. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time. Or your money back. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
I mean, I do like the assortment pack of stand-up. I do like that there, you know, the Kennison can come on, or Carrot Top, or, you know, Kennison, not anymore, obviously, but in the day, it was a lot of different styles of comedy. Do you think, this is a good question for you, where are we right now in the world of stand-up? Are they mimicking each other? Is Shane the newest kind of different type of guy? I mean, how do you see it?
Yeah, I think it's in, you know, I think comedy always comes in waves. So, and I think there's this interesting wave right now with like Nate.
Yeah.
And Shane too. I think that helps a bit, but basically there's a group of folks who appeal to an audience, and then they can get it broad, and then another one. Mm-hmm. So someone comes out, they make it broad. So I really feel like no other time, you kind of really have to pay attention to who's out there and what they're doing. And TikTok can give you a funny read on things. For the most part, what you want to see is just somebody, the way an audience really reacts to the comedian, which you don't see at all on social media.
Well, that's the other revolution for people of my age group. It's like comedians are not household names, sell out arenas. They either have a podcast or their Netflix special. I was on Bert Kreischer's show. Super nice.
Bert's great.
And he was flying. He was going to go to Europe the next day, and he's playing. He's going to headline Berlin and Edinburgh. It's like amazing.
One of our early specials we did with Bill Burr, and I remember Bill called and said, "Hey, are you guys in like other countries?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Yeah, because I just sold out shows in Denmark and Norway." And so it really, I think that Netflix special is the thing that's kind of at the center of
calling
the business
card.
Model.
You definitely need it, because the formula now, Dana, and you know this, and Ted knows this, is like these guys that are, you work on your hour. Everyone talks about their hour they're getting together. It's always like, it's insinuated it's for Netflix, but they're not buying them all, but they're like, I'm working on my hour. I'm doing my special. Doesn't mean Netflix is paying for it. Some people are just too new and they're not good enough, but the idea is to get an hour, to hopefully get on Netflix. And then that's a big calling card around the world. And then you go tour, you have to sort of come up with a pretty new hour, go out. So you bring a crowd out. Nate is great at this. Nate Bergazzi, he did this, and it just got bigger every time. And then you get more fans.
Yeah.
And you go out live and they see you, and then they go look for your new hour. And then you go out. And Bert did that. And, you know, Segura and Bill Burr, all these guys are, and you have to be good. And then they show up, and then you just keep, and no one was playing theaters like Ted back in Scottsdale. Leno maybe played Gamage Auditorium or Celebrity, or Seinfeld maybe.
I ran into you at the Seinfeld show at Gamage, and I don't remember who. I was trying to think of it the other day of whether it was Leno with him maybe, because they did. It was definitely Seinfeld. You were sitting like two rows ahead, and we
Jesus, you know, and that was hard to fill a theater. And you know, I when I do clubs during SNL or Just Shoot Me, or whenever, I would always just go book. Even if it's the Irvine Improv, you do even seven nights. It's a big room, but I never thought about jumping to theaters. And then my manager was like, "Why don't you just ever just book a theater tour? You never, if you're filling out this many seats in this, and so." I go, do people do that? Like, everyone's doing that. I was really late to the game.
I think I heard Bert Kreischer describe like the whole business of how to book clubs and how to do the Netflix special, what to do after that. And he's like, he's super tuned into the business model for sure.
And he has a pod and he has clips out. And then like Bobby Lee, Theo, like these guys.
It's a whole,
I know the younger generation really loves them.
Yeah.
It's great.
And it can put you, I mean, like you said, if it's a great hour, it can definitely change the trajectory of everything, and you can build on it and build on it. And it's a recurring thing. It's been working now for years, and it could be, and for me, it's been back to the diversity part. It might be something as big as 50,000 people at Dodger Stadium for Gabe Iglesias or Norm Macdonald's last special. He just shot it like this in front of a webcam.
Actually less than this. Remember we watched, didn't we watch it together? We were like, oh, yeah. Okay.
So this, I mean,
but you know what? It's the material. Everyone worries about the backdrop and the shit.
Yeah.
Are you funny or not? It really, you can look through all the clutter, and Norm was funny just talking. And the guys that play Dodger Stadium are funny. How many do you do? Do you do one? Is it up to one a week now or not?
There's a bunch. There's ones that we film. There's some that we license. So between all that, there's probably one a week that'll come out. Yeah. It was funny. When I first signed Chris to do his first special at Netflix, Chris goes, you got a lot of ordinaries, not a lot of specials.
Well, it used to be really a big, huge deal. But I mean, for you personally, it must be kind of satisfying, especially somebody who's kind of treading along, sort of their first big break, and then it's happening on your platform, and then their dreams come true. Kind of
That's
a fun
the best.
Part.
It is the best. Because you think about, again, kind of this is that technology, internet, what it brings to things, like what it would have taken for a Bert Kreischer to turn into a Bert Kreischer, you know, without it, it would have been really tough and long and been hard.
Ali Wong really did that. Pregnant One, it was great.
Yeah. And then you start rippling across the things. Like she just won all the awards for Beef and, made a really great movie for us a couple of years ago. So I think the cool thing is because we do so much, the platform is so open. You can, you know, David has done 3 great movies for Netflix and couple of great Netflix specials. And
well, what was the billions of minutes that World Missy got? I love the metric of billions of minutes watched for World.
The Wrong Missy.
Wrong Missy.
It's getting up there.
But you always mention Wrong Missy. But I think the Do-Over is another.
The Do-Over. Well, I have to give that a little bit to Sandler, because we did it together. So he gets some credit. But I
always say that whenever
Do-Over,
his name is mentioned on the podcast.
But I did Father of the Year, which was for Tyler, who wound up directing Wrong Missy. But Father of the Year, I think I talked to you guys after it, and maybe Scott Stuber said, hey, this did really well for us. We're going to keep looking for another one. And I'm like, oh, it came out? Like, it was when you didn't know how well it went because it just came out, and people would say, hey, I saw Father of the Year. And you go, great. But by the time Wrong Missy came out, there was numbers at the bottom. Yeah. And when it said number one, that means something. Now it's like looking in the paper and seeing what was the number one movie this weekend. So you go, one of you guys, you told me it was doing well. Then you said it's number one. Then he says number one in the world.
Yeah.
And then it was still. And then it just kept going. So luckily, the Wrong Missy really was another generation of people that have a big movie out that they talk. I get talked about every day. So
and it's fun. I talk to filmmakers all the time, and I do think that they really like, you know, the idea of the movie going through the traditional release and all those things, because that's what they grew up on.
Yeah.
But the truth is, they all say the same thing, which is when my movie premieres on Netflix, I hear it from the world. And it used to be that I would be screaming it to the world that my movie's out. Now the world tells me my movie's out.
That's true. Yeah. That's true, because it could be the next day you can hear about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was unfortunately during COVID, so I had to throw myself a little party.
By the way, I was wondering how much, you know, I love this podcast because it's all about SNL and because David knows I love SNL stories. I love listening to you guys. And I heard your Bill Simmons. I go, what's going on in that guy's life that he knows every single thing that ever happened on SNL?
I was like, Ted's the biggest fan.
I got nervous.
Ted hits me when he hears almost every podcast. He knows he's listening somewhere. So
yeah.
That was one of the reasons we thought it'd be fun to have you on. And then Bill Simmons, really aficionado. He had some deep cuts, and he didn't want to talk about anything sports. We had all these sports questions for him.
He was that's encyclopedic. That's pretty, it was spooky listening to.
I was stunned when I said, okay, what was the sketch of the night when Michael Jordan hosted? Oh, that was Stuart Smalley.
Yeah. And if you'd given me 15 minutes, I might've come up with that.
Also, when Michael Jordan was the, we were the all white basketball team in the 50s, and we didn't want him on our team, even though we were the shitty players, and we're like, we don't like this guy.
I was thinking about like what, you know, he said something interesting about like his age when the show started and all that. He's 2 years younger than, or did he say 68 or 69? I was born in 64.
That's when he was born. Oh, right, yeah, because like when he was 50, in like grade school and high school, it was perfect time.
Yeah. So me, I'm a complete TV nerd. I grew up, like, the reason I think that my direct line to why I love comedy so much was I didn't sleep a lot as a kid, and I used to watch all the old TV shows, Burns and Allen and Jack Benny, who were doing stand-up, essentially, and then acting out the shows. And so it was a real natural then to Carson. And so when SNL came on, I was I was 10 years old. I was born 64.
Yeah.
So
11, yeah.
And loved, would not miss an episode, you know, an episode. And then an album, they released a comedy album, The Best of SNL. Mm-hmm. It just played like a comedy album, and I play it nonstop. So I remember all those bits by line, you know, word for word, the word association with Chevy Chase and Richard Pryor.
Oh, yeah.
I got in trouble in school for repeating it.
Of course you did.
But like, even like the dumb things, like, Remember the singing group with Gilda and Jane Curtin and Lorraine Newman? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the tribute to Chevy Chase song they did.
Yeah.
Chevy, we love when you fall down each Saturday night on my TV. But anyway, so just like kind of being able to memorize and watch over and over again and see it. And that's before the internet, you know? So the idea that it's been that incredibly socially and relevant and will nothing I think will ever touch the relevance of Lauren and SNL in show business history.
No, I don't know if you've heard this quote. If Steve Higgins told me that Lauren wrote the Constitution of Saturday Night Live, and then he lets each cast and the writers kind of own it in their own way, and he's sort of a guiding person there. It'd be nice if Jan was in that sketch, you know? I mean, he sort of moves the sketches around very subtly. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas.
Loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com/welcometonow.
Reality TV has hit a new high on Hulu. From executive producer Jimmy Kimmel, the all-new Hulu original series High Hopes is finally here for your viewing pleasure.
The Hulu original reality series follows two budding entrepreneur brothers and their hilarious half-baked employees at one of the fastest-growing cannabis dispensaries in Hollywood. This workplace comedy showcases the highs and even more highs of the competitive marijuana industry.
More than just coworkers, the owners and bud tenders in High Hopes are one dope family.
You'll fall in love with these quirky characters as they pursue career aspirations, love, and fame, all under a slightly hazy cloud.
All episodes of the new reality series High Hopes are now streaming only on Hulu.
Any Lauren story before we got to let you go?
Yeah, no, my connection to the show is mostly fandom. Going to see the show live, to me, is still the most thrilling thing to do in the world. I never tire of it. The first time I got invited, Lauren invited me, and I got that seat like right in the center above the center stage.
Oh, right on top of the
I said, "Go, this is the best seat in the house."
Yes.
And right after the monologue, his assistant came up and said, "Hey, Lauren would like to know if you wanted to come down underneath and watch a show with him." And I go, will he ever invite me back if I say no? Because I really want to see how it works. This is an incredible vantage point. And she goes, yeah, sure, he'll understand. Sure. And he did. I didn't go down, and he did invite me back. But I think it was Cameron Diaz was hosting that night, and my buddy Isaac, who you guys met, texted me during the show to say, "Are you at SNL?" Because he could hear me laughing because that microphone was right above my head. Every time I've gone back though, it's just, I marvel at it. It just feels to me like exactly what TV was like, you know, 50, 70 years ago, even at the beginning of television, that mad rush between breaks for all the changes. And, so for me, that's amazing. Our history with SNL is that Dave Chappelle, actually signed his Netflix contract the night he hosted SNL after the election. And we had been talking to him for well over a year. And he said at the show, we went to the, and they said, my contract is signed and sitting on the seat. So he just signed it, set it on the seat, and went out and hosted the show. That was a pretty changing
thing. That's funny.
Very cool.
Yeah. And then I've gotten to know Lauren over the years, and I hugely admire. It's hard to say that you get to become friends with someone you so idolize like that. But I count him as a friend. And we were going to last year be co-honored by this organization called Pen America. And because of the Writers Guild strike, it got kind of nasty they had threatened to boycott it and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to pulled out of it. But in betweenhand, there was all kinds of controversy about whether or not Dave Chappelle could introduce me at this thing and on and on. So I sent him a note and to say, "I'm sorry, I can't be there. I didn't want to ruin it for you, blah, blah." And he calls me and says, "Ted, the hard part of thankless jobs is nobody thanks you."
That's a solid.
That's
Lorne.
Very, very Lorne. And that's that a surprisingly so good funny. Lorne, didn't you think, David?
That's a, and that's a good line.
Lorne has a. We call him Lorneisms. There's yeah. That's we'll add that to the bunch. He's quite a character yeah. around.
The worst part of thankless jobs.
Yes.
Nope, no one thanks you.
The minute you are huge, you feel yourself being less huge. Yeah. In show business.
Don't underestimate water. I think that was always my favorite.
Don't ever underestimate the value of water as he's pouring a giant thing. I think he said it to mine too. And he always drinking a lot of water. Everything out of his mouth is, you know, what he is that type of person. He's that type of person that takes a really big idea and distills it down. Yeah. Which is a sign of intelligence, I think.
I think, too, the guest kind of, you think going to the show and then staying at the party after for 50 years.
Fuck, I can't do that. I can't.
Another gigantic highlight for me with the show was 25 years ago, me and that same group of buddies that you guys had met, we went to Aspen for the comedy festival, the HBO mm-hmm. Comedy Festival. And you guys did the 25 year of SNL.
Oh,
and
wow.
Which felt like an SNL convention. There was so many SNL people.
Yeah.
There. And that's the first time I ever met Farley. First time I ever met Sandler.
Wow.
Wow. That was the
original cast all the way up to Will Ferrell's cast. We're up in the bleachers. Yeah. Is that where I did Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. You killed him that night. Yes. Yes.
Sorry.
That was a funny, I can't imagine what it was like to try to get a line in on that stage.
Oh, I don't think we talked. By the way, Farley had a rough go with it on that.
It was one. Only
it was oxygen problems. Mm-hmm. I think Norm needed oxygen, and it was a tough.
It was. Remember that awkward moment. Sorry to interrupt. Remember, David, the moment where it's a lead discussion, and he goes, "It's like being shot." I always said it. He said it. SNL is like being shot out of a cannon. That was the analogy.
Right.
And then, of course, Norm and Norm's brilliant. So, I don't know. You have to be shot out of a cannon to know the difference. I don't know. I don't know if it's exactly like being shot out of a cannon, more like people pretending to be other people or something like that. You know, and Mike turned red. Very Norm. We miss him. But,
You know, I miss Norm. No one else in my life. You know, most people go through their whole life trying not to look crazy. And when Norm got sick, he went out of his way to make you think he was crazy instead of sick.
Yeah.
Just sick wasn't funny.
I got mad at him. I look at my old texts. I'm like, I was going, Norm, you can't say you're coming to dinner and then just flake out. And he's like, David, there's COVID. I go, we've gone over it. I'm sitting 20 feet away from you in my house. It's you. We already agreed it's fine. And then he goes, it's an epidemic. I go, And then a week later, when are we having dinner? I go, why are you keeping this?
Your game? Episode of with Norm on his old Netflix special, his Netflix show, it's an act of jazz. It's not even a conversation. It's amazing.
I don't know if I told you that. I've never seen it, but I heard that whole year about that. And I was like, what did we do on that show that was so funny? I think you were there. And I think
you kept asking, is this a test show? Is it?
Yeah, because well, it was such a crummy piece of
the
shit.
Crew was like walking in front of you guys cranes and stuff, right?
This thing goes by, beep, beep, in front of the camera. I'm like, are we on a construction site? Anyway, Ted, let's let Ted go. He's got to get the reshoots in Korea.
Thank you for coming on, Ted. Fan. Thank you. We appreciate
the podcast.
It.
A fan of both of you. Love you both.
Love you both. See you soon, hopefully.
All right. Miss you, buddy.
Thank you.
Take care. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please follow, subscribe, leave a like, a review, all the stuff, smash that button, whatever it is, wherever you get your podcasts. Fly on the Wall is executive produced by Dana Carvey and David Spade, Jenna Weiss-Berman of Odyssey, Charlie Finan of Brillstein Entertainment, and Heather Santoro. The show's lead producer is Greg Holtzman.